I'm speaking now with Rick Carlin, reporter for the Times Union. Rick broke the story on Monday about the tanker trucks headed toward Cohoes from the Department of Defense carrying the AFFF. Welcome to the show, Rick.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good.
Before we get into that story, can you talk about how the Times Union is able to support investigative journalism during COVID?
Well, we just have the reporters that are working on stories. We're still doing what we normally do. The only difference is that we're doing it from home instead of from our newsrooms. So we're all pretty much working on stories. I mean, one of the big, you know, the difference is that so many of us are doing a lot of our stories are relating to the pandemic. Okay. Not the normal beats, although we still are covering some of the beats that, that we do, but a lot of the stories I've been doing, for instance, are pandemic related. However, of course the Norlight story is an ongoing story of interest to a lot of people. So when I found out about that, I jumped on that one. So we switch back and forth a little bit between the beats, but certainly in terms of, you know, investigating stories, investigative and investigating stories, there's really not a whole lot of difference in a lot of ways. We're still working away. We're just working from our homes, on our laptops and with our cell phones. And, you know, there's not the, face-to-face kind of collaboration you get with, you know, bouncing ideas off of editors and that sort of thing. But, you know, we have Slack, we have Zoom, we have cell phones. So we're still keeping in touch with one another.
Do you have any insight as to how your audience has been affected? You know, have you been able to retain your audience, or have the numbers changed?
The numbers online are up. People, they want to know about the pandemic. We've dropped the paywall for pandemic related news, which a lot of papers have done. And the readership numbers that I've seen are higher. The people are just, they're tuning in and they're hungry for every little bit of news about this pandemic, which I believe also filters out in the other aspects of the paper, where people now will start getting back into the habit of reading the paper online.
So,
you know, to do that, you need a subscription, but it's, you know, it's like a couple dollars a month or something. It's very inexpensive.
Can you talk about just briefly the importance of supporting local media and local journalism?
Oh, it's vital. I mean, without that, you don't know what's going on. I mean, you take the Norlight story, for example, that your folks are interested in as well. You know, you've got a company that is talking about burning and incinerating, you know, potentially toxic material. This would not have been known had it not been for the news reporting about this. The state knew that this was happening, but they didn't tell the city about it. The city had no idea until they just kind of stumbled. Somehow they got word of it, but without the media, whether it's newspapers, TV, radio, to disseminate this information, the people living in Cohoes probably wouldn't have any idea, or the people living downwind from Cohoes might not have any idea at all that this was an issue. So, I mean, there's an example right there. I mean, without local media, how are you going to know what's happening with the pandemic, whether you can go back to work, whether your business can open up again? Where do you go for nuts and bolts information? Like, where do you get tested? How do you get help with your unemployment check? That sort of thing as well.
So the story came out on Monday that the tankers were going to be expected on Tuesday. Later that same day, you released a follow-up that they were actually going to hold off on that. First, can you talk about the power of the media in changing the outcome of this story?
Well, yeah, I think the story helped, not to use a term, but it helped slow down, or maybe it helped stop the shipment of the material. You know, that there was an incineration order from the Department of Defense saying, okay, Norlight, come get these. As per our contract, we've got these 58,000 gallons of AFFF for you to come get. We're looking for you to come pick them up and bring them up there the week of the, will be the April, this week, week of May 19th. We did a story on it. The wheels started turning. People started making calls. The Schumer's office was aware of this. Most government, I shouldn't say all, but a lot are utterly immune, but most government agencies are somewhat sensitive to public reaction to things like that. And especially so when you've got a senator or a congressman or congresswoman saying, you know, hold off on this, because, you know, it's the elected officials who are ultimately the ones who set the budgets for these agencies. So they can't have a lot of influence over these agencies, for better or worse. So in this case, I think that the media publicity around it at least delayed, if not stopped for a while, these shipments of AFFF firefighting foam.
In your most recent article, you say that the shipments were actually scheduled for a week ago, starting on May 11th, but the story only broke on two days ago. How did you find out? Why was that?
Well, we had some sources tell us about these scheduled shipments. I'll leave it at that.
Last night, Assemblymember John McDonald held an environmental justice issues webinar where people could ask questions about issues, and the topic of Norlite came up, and he mentioned your article. Could I just play the clip right now and give you a chance to respond?
Yeah, I saw it. I watched it. Yeah.
Now, Norlite, the president, who I've now known for about 9 years, Sergio, yesterday there was a little bit of a dust-up. As you know, there was an article reported in the Times Union that there was word that 12 truckloads or 58,000 gallons of this material was coming to Cohoes to be burned. President, I called him, and within 30 seconds responded back and said, I'm aware of this story too. It's not true. We have no way of knowing where this came from. We would know if it was coming, because either they would be contracted to go pick it up, or they would have been notified that it's coming their way. So I have to think that was a false alarm, but it's a reminder that this could kick up at any time.
There were memos going back and forth within the Defense Logistics Agency and others, as well as some of the federal politicians, about this burn order that had gone. This incineration order that had gone to DEC, saying that they are planning to have this material shipped. I believe it was starting on the 15th of May and arriving by possibly on the 19th, which would have been Tuesday. So. Yeah, that's true. I mean, that was a factual story in terms of the shipments actually happening. No, that didn't happen. It kind of got derailed, really, once the story came out there, was out there.
This story now making national news, PFAS getting a lot of attention across the country. AFFF is just one issue. What are some of the major obstacles to reporting on this issue, to getting the answers that the public deserves, and major obstacles to investigative journalism?
Well, it gets complicated. I mean, the AFFF contains various varieties of PFAS. And there are dozens of iterations of the PFAS, you know, different molecular configurations of this. They all might be regulated differently if they end up getting regulated at all. Part of the problem is because it's essentially, at this point, is not really regulated, kind of like you would see with PCBs or DDT. It's hard to get, data sheets and statistics on how prevalent it is. That makes it difficult. And the other part of it is that PFAS, the more we're learning about them, it's quite prevalent. It's used in a lot of applications. You know, there's firefighting, there's fire departments all over the country. And a lot of them might have barrels of this foam lying around. It's an effective fire suppressant. They have them on airports. They have them on military bases. This 58,000 gallon shipment that we wrote about that was supposed to be coming to Cohoes but didn't, that was just from one naval station in Virginia, one naval station alone. They're turning up traces of the PFAS and AFFF in little towns like Cairo, New York, which is just south of us. There was an area where firefighters used to practice putting out fires, and they used the foam. Now that there's residue of the foam, and they're worried that it could could seep into the drinking water if they're not careful. So it's a fairly ubiquitous material. The PFOS in Hoosick Falls, which is east of Troy, right in eastern Rensselaer County, east of you guys, you know, they had a big problem with the water contamination. That was from using anti-stick surfaces that goes into Teflon. I'm told that the area around Hoosick Falls, New York, was once known as Teflon Valley, because there were a number of facilities, factories there that manufactured this chemical that went into Teflon. So that makes it, you know, that makes it difficult. Where do you start looking? And what do you look for? And then there's, you know, what it's really sort of an unknown exactly what the health impacts are also. It's, you know, so an epidemiologist from 3M told me, well, you know, there's been no clear cut indication of death from PFAS. And technically, he may be right in terms of that it's been indicated or recorded by the government, but they do seem to have a lot of problems in Hoosick Falls with it. There have been health issues that have come up that people are linking to the PFOS. So there's the other question. So it's a matter of finding where these chemicals are. It's a matter of, okay, to what extent are they causing health problems in people? Most of what we know now with the PFOS are the parts per billion in the blood of people. They do testing in the blood. And for instance, the people in Hoosick Falls had much, much, much higher concentrations of PFOS in their blood than the average American. I guess most of us have some level of this in our blood, if that's how ubiquitous it is.
Based on your information from your sources, the documents that you've seen, do you see any possibility at this time that Norlite could become a storage facility for this foam?
That's a good question that I've been wondering. I don't really know. You know, they're it's an aggregate plant. So they have trucks going back and forth with full of gravel that they're putting in their kiln to create aggregate, which goes into roads and that sort of thing. You know, do they have the ability, for instance, to store 12 tankers of AAA foam on their property? Do they have the space for that? And B, do they want to do that? I'm not sure that the contract calls for that. I think the contract talks about incineration. I think it's possible, but I don't think they're looking to get into the storage business. I think the idea was that they're trying to figure out ways to incinerate this foam.
What exactly is an incineration order?
Well, saying, under our contract, you have to come get the foam with your trucks or hire trucks, take it away and incinerate it.
So these other incinerators across the country that are already contracted with the DOD, they are refusing the foam.
Yeah, that was an interesting piece of the story. You know, that there was, since the contract was signed, I believe it was 2018, there's a moratorium. So Norlite says, well, we have a moratorium. We can't really burn this. We can't incinerate it in the Cohoes plant. But there's, I think, seven. There were other facilities that do this. But they're not taking the foam now, because I think they're concerned, at least according to what Norlite was saying in some of the email exchanges, they're concerned about whether this turns hazardous or not. And, you know, if something turns out to be hazardous, no incineration plant really wants to take on that burden. It could come back and bite them, you know, a year later or a month later. People were saying, what were you doing? You were incinerating this hazardous material. Why were you doing that? I mean, they're aware of the problems with that. So now there's a big question mark about, what happens to all this AFFF? Does it become like nuclear rods or nuclear fuel waste? Does it just sit there for years and years and years on end in sight because they don't know what to do with it? I don't know. We don't know yet.
Certainly. And I have a feeling that a lot more of the story is going to continue to come out.
Yeah, it's going to be an ongoing story, I suspect. Yeah.